I'm Stephen May. I'm a fractional CMO for culture and media brands. And this is Untalented by Unknown and Canva.
What do you do? Can you explain it to someone in your family or a 10-year-old?
I am a fractional CMO. What I do is merge marketing and content to drive big cultural narratives. So essentially, I make brands cool and I add substance through content, marketing, and social.
Nice. What is something that helped you move through your career faster?
I think conviction and ability to assess risk. So I spent my career doing a lot of subversive innovation. Part of the reason that works is because I'm very good at figuring out what could go wrong and then mitigating against it. That means you can back yourself when it comes to bolder ideas. You can back yourself when it comes to, I guess, strategies that kind of go out of industry norms. And I think that's super, I guess that's super effective because it means the work that you do really stands out.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And then talking money, What is a top earner in your industry? What could that look like figure-wise?
You're probably earning six figures with share options and things like that. I think in the UK, it's significantly lower.
As the case of every period. Okay, nice. And then what inspired Sneak and Peace? How did that begin?
Sneak and Peace was inspired by a guy that was really passionate about sneakers, a guy that really wanted to integrate tech and e-commerce and find new ways to surface product in line with kind of like beautiful creative. So it was started by a guy named Dom. He basically built this platform that allows you to integrate video, product, and do it in a way at scale without kind of like the big infrastructure that you normally need to build e-commerce businesses. Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, I was really attracted to it because there's a few things. One, it ties into my passion for sneakers. Two, I had just built an e-commerce marketplace that was very expensive, that had a lot of people, and financially it just couldn't work because of, I guess, like the cost to income ratio, and the opportunity for that just meant that you needed to invest a lot. What was really attractive about this proposition is managed to figure out a way to do it through affiliates, where you can still capture data, where you can still kind of have any product that you want and do it in a way that feels premium aspirational. So I think what started it is a desire to create an e-commerce business that merged different types of media that was driven around discovery and can be scaled with little resource.
Amazing. And how has your experience across large corporations shaped your personal approach to leadership now?
Well, I think being in large corporations has helped me kind of understand, I guess, like the nuance of the expectation piece. So with large corporations, the work feels secondary to the things that are around it. So a lot of it is political, a lot of it is built around bureaucracy, and it's designed to essentially not rock the status quo. And that's because sometimes these large organizations are very successful, so they don't want to do anything that might disrupt shareholder value. Mm-hmm. We're running a small business. Our whole thing is around driving innovation. It's around kind of like pushing the needle forward. It's around kind of, I guess, like creating space where we can essentially set the agenda for marketing, commerce, for content. And not having those barriers allows you to basically move with speed, to move fast and break things. And I think that's where a lot of that innovation applies. I also think for certain people, not having those barriers and being able to kind of try things leads to more innovation because essentially you have the space to manifest things that feel impossible and make them possible.
Nice. What cultural shifts do you see impacting youth marketing today?
I think it's interesting because I feel like because the media world has shifted so much, a lot of the spaces that used to breed amazing youth talent no longer exist in the same capacity. So if you look at youth media brands like Vice or prior to that MTV, a lot of some of the best creatives that exist now in the industry have come from those environments where you have an opportunity to get lots of exposure to lots of different things, and you have the freedom to kind of like, I guess, like play around with creative frameworks, et cetera, et cetera. I guess on the flip side, at the moment with like TikTok and kind of like the creator economy, everyone is getting space to do their own thing. The difference is it's missing that layer of exposure to the complexities of different production types, of different creative processes that might potentially not provide the tools to kind of like do things that might take things further. Like, you know, in some ways, like social has progressed content and kind of like found new ways to kind of get the messaging out to different corners of the world. But in other ways, we've probably also regressed in some ways in terms of like production of like production output or simplicity of storytelling or all these other things. So I think youth culture is up for grabs. I think there's still a world where you could mix kind of like old media knowledge with new media tactics and distribution ecosystems. So I think it's an exciting time, but it's definitely the pathway doesn't feel as obvious as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like no set blueprint now in a way, which is really tricky. We've already spoken a little bit on subversive innovation. Can you tell us more about how you've used this in your career and how you think it's accelerated your work?
Yeah, so I think with subversive innovation, it's about, for me, it's a tactic that's kind of worked, because like, I guess like my history has been going to businesses that have either never had marketing teams or have a very specific problem they need to solve. What I've identified is the industry tends to follow trends, and those trends are usually quite superficial. So what my kind of approach has been is to basically go in, identify the problem, and then figure out like the framework for what the solution is. I think, and I'll give you an example. So at Lad Bible, like the challenge was people weren't advertising with them because the perception of the brand and the audience wasn't the most positive. Also, they hadn't done any premium work. So advertisers were like, well, what are we spending money on if we can't see that value? I think as a platform that was initially, you know, driven by UGC content, driven by kind of like, I guess, like short form, quick to consume, that whole ecosystem isn't necessarily conducive to kind of like broader, comprehensive like brand work. So most people, because it was kind of like a platform built on humor, I would have imagined that most people would have been like, right, what we need to do is get the brand out there, make, you know, do a campaign that's funny and kind of like really kind of like just tell people who we are. My approach was, I think we should look at the problems of why people think the audience is the way it is and why people think we're not capable of kind of like creating these kind of bigger brand pieces and address them. So for me, I was like, if the audience perceive Lad as a certain way, then let's change what the meaning of Lad is. So I did the redefining Lad strategy, which is essentially two things. One was to basically reframe the community as a community of positive force, and we did that through campaigns like You Okay Mate and the Trash Isles, which were designed to basically showcase the impact of the community to kind of drive big cultural narratives. So, you know, mental health, like plastic in the ocean, those kind of drove waves. I built those campaigns that were tied to the ingredients that made our channel popular, so kind of like short form video that kind of like drove extensive reach, but I paired that up with long form, high production documentaries that drove narrative. Those high form kind of like production video pieces, they were designed to showcase our production capabilities, but also anchor the narrative around something kind of like bigger than the content that you'd consume, like, you know, for like 10 or 15, 20 seconds. Then pair that with the editorial function to show them how words and how our influence can influence an audience. Mm-hmm. Second part was charging pop culture. So it was like, we had such a big audience at the time. It was like over 1 billion people. What we did was we leveraged that audience to get access to talent. Most people do junket interviews and it's, you know, usually pretty simple. What we did was we got movie stars to basically create, to work with them to create franchises so that so it looked like we were creating kind of like highbrow studio content with big name talent. And then the third part was disrupting broadcast models. So disrupting broadcast models is about kind of like identifying that our audience was massive and that we could essentially stream something on our Facebook page at the time or on Instagram and be able to generate like 5-10 million views pretty instantly. So it was reframing all those things into a package that, like, you know, we've done it now, but like at the time people just didn't think it made sense or didn't think it was possible. But for me, it made perfect sense because it tied into all the challenges they needed to address.
Yeah, I mean, it made it digestible as well. And it's when you are putting something into a package, it's then so much easier to sell that package. And especially when people can see that it's worked again and again and again, it then makes so much more sense in their heads, right?
Yeah. And also you want proof points to be able to point to. So I think that's the thing. So people are like, how can you say lad is a gender neutral term? Well, you can point to the cultural shift around kind of like assigning gender to certain things and point to the fact at the time, like there was like this big streetwear like resurgence and that actually a lot of brands were creating gender neutral clothing. Like there's all these culture points. And then if you point to the content, like how can you say that our audience is all these stereotypes? If A, there's a billion people in our audience, but also B, like we're able to create the biggest movement around plastic in the ocean, like more so than Sky, who was doing a similar campaign at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing. We touched on it slightly before, but with your experience in larger corporations, you've seen bureaucracy be a major driver of burnout within the creative industries. Why do you think companies still protect these systems, even though they're stifling work and innovation?
I think fear and lack of understanding of how the creative process works and how to foster creative talent. I think a lot of big corporations has a one-size-fits-all approach to people. And I think the reality is creative people are built differently. They have a different point of view and they work differently. So you can't put those people in the same structure because fundamentally what that means is it doesn't connect. And if you're bringing these creative people and then asking them to kind of like manage stakeholders, then you're not using them to the best of their ability.
Mm-hmm.
If that's their passion and that's why they're doing the job and that's what they're good at, like that frustration, I think, ultimately leads to burnout.
100%. And then with the rise of AI, what element are you finding the most exciting about the advancements in this space? And how are you seeing yourself using this in your day-to-day?
I think the interesting thing about AI is I think AI is going to be a superpower for people that are the best at what they do. Because fundamentally, what AI is going to help people do is duplicate their brains. And you know, that's the positive aspect. So for me, being able to be a fractional across 3 companies is something that probably wouldn't have been able to happen in a previous life. But because I have the systems and the infrastructure in place, I can essentially leverage my skill set, experience, and knowledge in a way that previously just wasn't possible. I think the challenge for that moving forward is that to really kind of make it work, you need to have a really strong point of view. You need to have a really good idea of how kind of like marketing, creative, and all those things intersect together. And you really need to understand how to scrutinize kind of like creative responses, scrutinize research, scrutinize all those things. And I think fundamentally the big challenge around that is if people are starting to use AI, especially people with no experience or little experience, they're going to miss the learning curve that you need, where you make mistakes, where you try things in real life, where you're experimenting. And my concern is that means that people are not going to be equipped to leverage AI in the right way, which means that work diminishes or they end up not being able to pursue certain careers because they don't have the tools to be able to kind of work in that space.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So you're seeing it much more as a tool to be harnessed rather than something to base a career off.
100%. At the moment, I think 100%. I mean, I don't know, like AI keeps changing. So it could be, we could get to a point where it's so smart that it could, you know, take over everything. But I think what it feels like to me is it's reaching a point where it can replace a lot of kind of more entry level roles. Mm-hmm. And that's concerning because what then, how do people break into the industry and learn?
Yeah, how are we fostering the next generation of the industry, right?
Yeah.
Nice.